Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Who are the millennials? Once dubbed the new great generation, they're over 70 million strong and they're our biggest generation next to the baby boomers. At first, they were once considered the great optimists who were bound to change the world. Nowadays, they're more often chided for deferred adulthood, and their generation has been buffeted by 9/11 and the global financial collapse. But my guest today says they're still optimistic, although it's somewhat tempered, and they will change the world just by their sheer size. He calls them the first globals who consider themselves citizens of the world. Well, my guest today is the founder of the Zogby Poll, public opinion pollster and author John Zogby. Since 1984, he's been polling and probing the public's opinion on elections, politics, the economy, culture, and social movements here in the U.S. and abroad. Today, he's a senior analyst at Zogby Analytics, and he's the author of two books, including his latest on the millennials. First Globals, Understanding, Managing, and Unleashing Our Millennial Generation. It's co-authored with Joan Snyder-Kuhl. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations and the University of Tulsa earlier this week, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. John Zogby, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Your book refers to what's commonly known as the millennial generation as the first globals. Now, this is a big generation next to the baby boomers. They're probably our largest. They were the mini baby boom.
Right.
They're going to have enormous influence like the baby boomer generation. So what are the reasons for that change of title? What personifies this generation?
It's something I began to notice really about a dozen years ago when I started polling about them in detail, that they really had a planetary sensibility, that the world was their playing field. And as I got the answers to many polls that revealed that, you know, as an historian, I went back to try to figure out what made that. And, you know, what I discovered is these kids played more soccer than baseball and football. That's very important. They knew the World Cup, and I didn't. They were so facile with the new technologies that we began to see them identifying their friends and acquaintances in terms of social networking, going as far back as the 90s, actually. The internet, MTV, introduced them to the entire world and videos from the entire world, global fashion, global music. And so they already had this incredible planetary sensibility, so much so that among the many questions that I asked about how they identify themselves, this was the only group that was as likely to call themselves citizens of the planet Earth as call themselves American citizens. And Rich, it was across the board. You know, obviously the best educated and the most upscale, we're heading in that direction already, but this transcends race and region, income, educational level. It's a national phenomenon.
Really, even those in our lowest socioeconomic groups, they also have that aspiration?
Let's say that the concentration among those groups is not as high as your Ivy League grads and your major private school grads, but the phenomenon exists among low income. The aspiration exists among low income. As we're seeing in the developing world today, the power of the mobile device alone puts people in touch with so many things that they've never been in touch with before.
Well, I think the whole social media thing is whatever your interest group is, if it's a fringe idea or thought, you know, like a genre, say, or maybe it's science fiction, all of a sudden, that's not the few guys that like science fiction in your small town. It's anybody in the world.
Anybody in the world. And add to that as well, these are the kids. I call them kids because they are. These kids are the beneficiaries of integrated schools and multicultural communities. So all those demographic and policy shifts means that the likelihood of they're going to all white schools and all black schools are less and less, and so they've mixed. They're multicultural.
Now, this generation has been through a lot. In fact, one of the things I've noticed is how this generation has been characterized. I think when they were young children and just becoming teenagers, it was thought they were going to be the next greatest generation, that they, you know, they'd had volunteering programs from the time they entered school.
That's right.
They were altruistic. the parent-child dynamic was vastly different than earlier generations. There wasn't as big a generation gap between the generations.
That's right.
And they were incredibly optimistic about the future. Now they've been through 9/11. They have been through the financial collapse in 2008. Has that changed them any?
It has. Enough so that we're watching. I'm watching a phenomenon, the Great Recession. If someone is 31, 32 years old, that's tantamount to their entire adulthood being spent in a Great Recession. And so what we are seeing is a small but steady growth, 12 to 15% of these first globals that I call CENGA, C-E-N-G-A, college educated, not going anywhere. Mm. That's troubling. Yeah. It's troubling in a lot of ways, troubling to them and troubling to us, both in terms of lost opportunities, but also this is the transformative group that's going to get us out of the morass, really, that we're in today.
Yeah, because it's the next big generation.
It is. You know, if you take it from 1979 to 1994, which is in the book, that's 72 million. Baby boomers are 78 million. But we're already adding 1995, and I suspect, barring another cataclysmic, life-changing event over the next couple of years, that you're probably talking about a group that rivals baby boomers.
Now, it's interesting. Well, I talked about that earlier definition of millennials or first globals, and that was the initial thought. Now, in recent years, it's been deferred adulthood.
Yep.
It's been narcissism because of those social networks and the so much me time. It's I think in the workplace, I think there's a sense that some are not willing to work the entry-level jobs and move up. They want to start in the middle and move up.
Okay, let me answer those at a time.
Yeah.
Okay. Number one, I was at a college in eastern Pennsylvania about a month ago, and a young man, a student, raised his hand and said, "You know, Mr. Zogby, how can people deal with our narcissism?" I said, "Son, I'm a baby boomer. We've given you so much, but we're not giving you our narcissism. That's ours. You guys are okay." I think the answer about the narcissism is why I wrote the book. Look, 20-somethings are always self-centered. I just found some letters that I had sent to my mom back home when I was in college. Oh, God, Rich, I was so annoying. So, I mean, that's part of it. We focus too much on there being 20-something, but it's the historical events that have created these unique values. You know, a college professor of mine told me that December 6th, 1941, he and a bunch of guys were sitting in the dorm talking about girls and talking about sports and talking about clothes. And then the next morning was Pearl Harbor, and on Monday morning, they were out registering for the draft. They weren't born, they became the greatest generation when history intruded. In this instance, the other thing you pointed out, they're different in the workplace. They're not 9 to 5 because their lives are 7 and 24. And so they're on all the time. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect is the different work patterns that they bring. They're horizontal in their decision-making process, and they want to work in teams. They're not hierarchical. And frankly, I think hierarchical, bureaucratic kinds of structures have outlived their usefulness. And then finally, what I would say is that they want to change the world, and there's a sense of urgency. I mean, 85% say, "I want to change the world." 71% say, "I want to have the kind of workplace that affords me that opportunity." So in that regard, they're very, very different.
Perhaps the first generation to acknowledge their narcissism. I mean, that's the one thing that's really interesting is I think other generations had it too, but we're oblivious to it. They're very frank about it. I know there have been numerous, our generation's narcissistic. Yes, of course we are.
They've internalized a lot of the criticism about themselves, and it's damaged their ego. That and the Great Recession. That was one of the questions you asked about the recession. You know, as an employer, young people would come up to me in the middle part of the last decade or so and say, I have options, you know, but tell me, how do I get to be COO of Zogby International over the next 3 years? I can tell you that the Great Recession has had its impact. You hear a whole lot more, I just want to get started. Mm-hmm. If you could just give me something to do, you, in fact, don't even really have to pay me or pay me very much. So I think maybe that's a little bit of a silver lining in what otherwise is a very troubling trend.
Yeah. My guest today is John Zogby. He's the founder of the Zogby Poll and a senior analyst at Zogby Analytics. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He's co-author of First Global's Understanding, Managing, and Unleashing Our Millennial Generation. He wrote it with Joan Snyder Kuhl. Well, let's talk about some of the attributes. I read in one interview that one of the biggest challenges for this generation and how we change our institutions to accommodate them is education. What is different about this generation in regards to education?
Everything. Lots of complaints about digital, handheld devices, communicating with fingertips and thumbs, and what some would consider a lack of focus, but others might consider focusing on only what is really useful and really important. The thing is, a lot of brick and mortar institutions are going to be shook out over the next decade or so. The emphasis is going to be not only on online education and its affordability, but also on global education, so that I may go to the University of Tulsa to matriculate, but the University of Tulsa will probably be more of the broker that puts me in programs in Paris and wherever those programs make the most sense for me. A lot of it being done online and on my own time. What we're already seeing in the phenomenon of adult education, you're going to be seeing a whole lot more with 18, 19, and 20-year-olds simply because parents are starting to revolt, can't afford it.
Yeah. And you're talking about higher education.
Higher education. Yeah. And frankly, when now can you project a return on investment for $100,000, quarter of a million? You're also starting to see the revolt among major donors who are saying, all right, you came to me, I gave, you built a sushi bar to appeal to freshmen, and now you're coming and asking me to give again, and I think I've had it.
Yeah. So big changes in higher education, but also in K through 12.
Oh, absolutely.
I think I read that you said, because of this global outlook, we're going to be more involved in starting foreign languages at an early age, say first, second grade, and it could be Chinese,
yes,
or Arabic or a dialect of Indian, where the other major population powerhouses are, which is where maybe more of the jobs will be.
For starters, this group is already multicultural in terms of its demographics as well as its outlook. But one of the things that we write about in the book, 60% say that being fluent in a foreign language is very or somewhat important to their future. 33% of this group, this is far higher than any other age cohort, say that it is very important to their future. Now, are that many taking foreign languages? No, but we've never seen that level of aspiration or identification of the importance of foreign languages. That's certainly one piece of it. And to really learn a foreign language, you have to go to the foreign model. You can't expect someone to take 2 years in high school, never ever use it again, and hence be bilingual. But the other piece of it is what we're teaching kids. I'm a historian. Facts are very important to me. Historical context is very important to me. These kids are not being trained in the right sorts of things. In a world where, and I'm not tongue-in-cheek at all, but in a world in perhaps 10 or 15 years when all the knowledge that's on the internet can be implanted right here above your right eyebrow, it doesn't really matter that you can master and have the memory of all those facts. It's how do you access it? When do you access it? How do you use it? Who connects the dots? Mm-hmm. There is so much power that we're going to use in our right brains. And so how do we make decisions? How do we solve problems? How do we work in teams? Yeah. How do we work in teams over long distances?
the facts can be found on a phone, connecting the dots between the facts and what it means. That's the real learning.
And that's the world we're in, big data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the data is already there. Now, who's going to make any sense out of it?
We talked about these two big events that have shaped their generation, 9/11, a post-security world, if you will, the financial collapse, a lot of these institutions that for a generation was, you know, the best and brightest migrated to them. What is the likely effect on politics as a result of those two big events?
You know, it's very interesting that, first of all, this group is voting Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're not voting Republican. So they're rejecting the GOP. A lot of that has to do with social issues. So just in this past election alone, while President Obama didn't do as well among 18 to 30-year-olds as Senator Obama had done 4 years earlier, ultimately it was over the weekend that young women decided to come out to vote. And they told us post-election polls, we come out to vote against the GOP. They just scared the bejesus out of us. So that's one aspect of it. But frankly, in talking to this group, they want to resolve problems. They don't yell. They want reasoned arguments. They want no nonsense. And so the old paradigm is liberalism versus conservatism. Now, those two circles used to have a slight overlap so that reasonable conservatives and reasonable liberals could sit down, play racquetball with each other, have some whiskey.
Hammer out an agreement.
There are no concentric circles. This group is ushering in an entirely new debate, and this is the research I'm working on now, of libertarianism versus communitarianism. Libertarian, less government intrusion in my life, less debt, focused spending, that sort of thing.
Less government control of social issues, too.
Less government control of social. That's pure libertarianism.
Yeah, right.
Versus communitarianism, where the individual, I get my identity from my community, and in return, I have responsibility back to my community. It doesn't lead with government is the solution. It leads with the notion my community is the solution to poverty, health care, education, and so on. Those are softer forms of ideologies, and there is interesting concentricity. They're concentric just enough. So I think both the attitude and the outlook and these two softer ideologies are among the things that make me hopeful.
You know, when you describe them, though, it sounds like that the concentric part of the circles is still pretty small.
It is. It is pretty small, but it doesn't have to be large. Look, not a huge amount of legislation gets passed every year.
Right.
You know, we tend to be very conservative in this country when it comes to reforms, but we tend to make reforms until, say, the last decade or so.
What's really been interesting to me about this generation is how they're transforming the social net of that community-mindedness you're talking about. I think at first, you know, they were not going to join the Rotary Club. They're not going to join the Lions Club or things like that. But they found their own networks. And I guess my question is, how is this transforming our social network within a community? Say, from, you know, religion, philanthropy, to, you know, social organizations.
Wow. Big answer, big answers to those. First of all, the church of the future, the church of now and into the future for these young people is not a glass cathedral. It's a living room. Essentially, it's 12 to 15 peers, as much as a support group and a network for how I can make my community better as it is to share readings and worship.
Philosophical.
Be introspective and worship a higher being. In terms of involvement, I work with economic development groups. I work with chambers. I work with United Ways. And essentially, you know, what I've told them is you can embrace this group by just simply empowering them because they have a social network and know how to do it and how to use it. So they can be mobilized to resolve problems. They can be mobilized on a whim to contribute more money than you ever dreamed of. The old model of getting 100 people to give $10,000 has been totally transformed into 10,000 people who can give $100.
Kickstarter and flash mobs.
Exactly.
Yeah. A Kickstarter, you have a campaign, you raise the money $100 at a time, $50 at a time. Flash mobs, if you need a group of people to be there, boom, social networks, and boom, they're there.
And they're there because it's different and it's cool. And in my own little way, I'm doing something. I'm either helping a retailer, which is important in and of itself, or I'm helping to raise money for a cause.
My guest today is John Zogby, founder of the Zogby Poll and co-author of First Global's Understanding, Managing, and Unleashing Our Millennial Generations. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. In our last couple minutes, can we talk about the future of polling? Because
yeah.
I think in the last presidential cycle, there was lots of thoughts. Were we hitting all the right demographics? Because once again, this generation, they don't have home phones. And that's one of the primary contact tools. You also get a sense that polling has become so ubiquitous. I mean, we had a mayoral campaign that lasted 7 months. People were not answering their phones in the evening because they knew it was either a pollster or, it was tracking polls for a mayoral campaign. Has this changed how we get our information about polling, whether it's about politics or anything, any sort of public opinion?
Yeah, for starters, I go back to the days. I started in 1984. We used to hear, shh, I'm on a long-distance call. Somebody's calling me and asking me questions. This is important. That is not our world. There was no call waiting. There was none of the there were answering machines, but not many people had them. Today, landline penetration in the U.S. is what it was in 1963. 62% of households have a landline only.
And that's probably going to go down, you think?
It's going down probably during the duration of this show, it's going down. And so we have, to do telephone polling, we have to include at least 35-36% of our calls that are cell phone, among cell phone only individuals or households. The further problem is that, a typical poll is not, hi, how are you? Who are you going to vote for? Thank you very much. It's 40, 60, 80, 100 questions, and frankly, you're not going to do that on a cell phone. And so we've been among the pioneers in online polling, and now among the pioneers in text message polling, where we've married the technology. So we will choose randomly telephones and invite people to take a survey by pressing this link, clicking on this link. And then there's all the sorts of controls that you have to ensure that they can't take it twice, that they can't forward it to friends and that sort of thing.
I think of that as sort of being self-selecting, but I suppose deciding to participate in a poll in the first place is self-selecting.
Rich, when I started, our response rates were 65%. Every three people we got on the phone, two would take the survey. And now our response rates, in the height of a presidential election, close one, they're all close these days, 22 to 26% response rates. When we get into major metros like New York and L.A., we're looking at 6%, 8% response rates. That's self-selective right there.
Uh-huh. Now, how do you, I know it's waiting that from that 6 or 8% that will talk to you, but that makes it very critical, and it can make it very easy to make errors just because if you assign a weight, just even a small measure that's high or low, you've really skewed the poll.
But it's very important that when we talk about weights, we have to talk about distribution. So, in other words, we experimented in robo-polling, just wanted to see something about it. So we did some polls in Ohio, and twice we got 66 African-Americans. Not bad. But 23 of those 66 were Republican. Now, look, tongue in cheek, there's probably 23 African American Republicans in the entire state of Ohio. Bottom line is, if I need to move that 66 and make it a larger number to be representative, what I'm doing is I'm weighting a poorly distributed figure. Mm-hmm. And so that poll is useless. So what we need to, the science of this polling is to make sure that our methodology is as random as it possibly can be and that the distribution is reasonable enough. Say I need 10% who are Hispanic. If when the poll is conducted, 2% come in, I can't wait up to 10%. If it comes in 6 or 7%, that's conceivable. But you see, then I have to look at who that 6% are. That's one of my great mess-ups in my career. The California Democratic primary of 2008, I had Obama up by 10 and Hillary won by 10. I was in a fetal position for the next 72 hours. You know, when we examined it, we didn't do badly on the numbers of Hispanics. We just had too many young Hispanics, and you can see what that'll do.
Yeah. Well, how does that affect the polling going forward as far as knowing what the public really thinks? Because despite certain administrations in the past, polling is a very important part of formulating policy.
It still is, and it can be done, and it can be done very, very well. We just need to be open to new methodologies. The most dangerous words in the American language today are, we're going to do it the way we've always done it. And I dare say that is radio and universities, the Boy Scouts, church, and polling.
All right. Well, we wish you great success. And the name of the book is First Globals, a generation that's going to have a large influence on our country over the next 40 to 50 years. John Zogby, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Zogby is the founder of the Zogby Poll and the Zogby Companies. He is currently a senior analyst at Zogby Analytics and the co-author of First Globals, Understanding, Managing, and Unleashing Our Millennial Generation. He was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations and the University of Tulsa earlier this week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed a portion of today's program or one of our earlier programs and you want to hear it online, you can anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.